Good afternoon, everyone. This is the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Human Services. It's Thursday, March 21st, first day of spring.
Really? Couldn't tell by looking outside.
I know.
My house this morning.
I would like to open a work session on Senate Bill 420. Sandy?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we had a public hearing on Senate Bill 420 on February 19th. You'll recall this is the bill about breast density, and in performing if you perform a mammogram to notify the patients of the results and the possible risk of breast cancer, if the individual is then it's indicated that that individual has dense breast tissue. It requires a health benefit plan to reimburse the cost for the ultrasound. And I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
This has an emergency clause effective on passage. You do have a Dash 4 amendment. The Dash 4 amendment deletes Section 2, which was the requirement for the insurance reimbursement, a.k.a. the mandate. It clarifies that the facility is responsible to provide the notification, not the individual in the facility, and it also provides a dense breast tissue definition. We have a fiscal and revenue on the Dash 4, minimal expenditure impact on the Dash 4, and no revenue impact on the Dash 4.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 4 amendment to Senate Bill 420.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 4 amendments into Senate Bill 420. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 420 as amended by the Dash 4 amendment to the Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 420 as amended with the Dash 4s to the floor with do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hayward?
Aye.
Senator Cano?
Excused.
Senator Shields?
Excused.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries, and Senators Dingfelder and Steiner Hayward will co-carry this bill. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 420 and open a public hearing on, we're doing 123 next?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 123. Sandy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this bill is brought before you at the request of Children First of Oregon, I believe. But that might be an error. This bill requires the Department of Human Services to adopt rules establishing the Oregon Foster Children's Bill of Rights. It directs the department to conduct a periodic review to ensure the Bill of Rights complies with principles outlined in the Act, directs DHS to promote foster child involvement in the state foster care child welfare policy, as well as the development of the Bill of Rights. It applies to foster children placed in substitute care on or after the effective date of the Act. You have a Dash 1 amendment that clarifies the foster youth rights under the U.S. Constitution and federal law and does some other things that I believe some of the presenters will be speaking to, Madam Chair.
Great. Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon State Senate District 22. Senate Bill 123 comes directly from Oregon's most vulnerable children, our youth in the foster care system. I will let them speak for themselves, but I have to say I'm incredibly impressed with their work on this bill and just how commonsensical it is. Some of you know my wife and I have been foster parents for over, I guess, 5 or 6 years, and I've seen firsthand, as I know many of you have, how chaotic and unstable the foster care system can be on its worst days. I've seen, for example, judges make monumental decisions about a young boy's placement without his attorney being present, a judgment that eventually ended up being very much not in that child's best interest. I've seen just kind of everyday chaos things that the foster youth expected to have happen just not happen. And at minimum, I think what we need to do is to try to make the DHS system less chaotic than the systems that they were living in before that required them to be removed from their house. So last July, I attended the Foster Youth Connections Youth Summit, where foster youth gathered to brainstorm ways to improve the foster care system for foster youth and those in the foster care system. It was clear that most foster youth do not know what their rights are in the system, and too often their rights are not upheld. Senate Bill 123 simply requires the Department of Human Services to notify foster youth of their rights, and our foster youth deserve so much more in the foster care system than this, but this is one simple step we can take to protect foster youth. I'll let others speak to the details of the bill itself, but one thing that I wanted to put on the record that one of the advocates for foster youth brought to me is the legislative intent around one of the amendments. And so if I could just read this sentence into the record. The legislative intent of SB 123-1, the dash one amendment, is not for DHS to decide unilaterally when it is or is not appropriate for a child to attend a court hearing. That's not the intention of this amendment. Certainly, it is the attorney's job to counsel any child or youth client about their role as a party in their own case and when it may or may not be in the child's or youth's interest to attend a particular hearing. Ultimately, it is not DHS's role to dictate when youth may or may not attend hearings on their own cases. The child and DHS are co-equal parties to the court case. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you. And Senator Shields, thank you for bringing this bill. Having chaired the interim task force on foster youth in which you served, it's really great to see this as part of the process. My only concern about the bill, the way it's currently written, is why does this only apply to children who enter the system after the effective date? We've got over 8,000 kids in our child welfare system right now, and I would think that they deserve these rights as well. I recognize that implementing them retroactively, but there should is, you know, with that many kids all at once can be tough, but really? What am I missing here? Is it just a logistics problem or?
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, in the course of my dealings as a state senator, I have learned to let others take that lifeline. And so I will throw that lifeline to those who are more involved in the crafting of the particular language
okay.
of the bill.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank
good
you.
Good point.
Mm-hmm. All right. With that, I would like to call Pamela Butler, Kane Stellings, and Patrick Kindred. No, I thought I had called Pamela first.
Right.
Yep.
Okay.
Sorry. Get settled here. Everyone can hear. So, Chairman Zanderson, members of the committee, my name is Pamela Butler, and I'm the Child Welfare Policy Manager at Children First for Oregon. As many of you know, Children First's mission is to make long-term systemic change by advocating for programs and policies that keep children healthy and safe and strengthen families. I am here today clearly in support of SB 123, which will create, as you've heard, a Foster Youth Bill of Rights for the nearly 13,000 children and youth who experience the foster care system every year. As you all know, and you've heard from Senator Shields, the life of a child in foster care is chaotic and complex, and the outcomes for youth who leave the system are pretty poor. So current and former foster youth of the Oregon Foster Youth Connection have spoken loud and clear, and they believe that SB 123 will make a difference going forward for their life in the system. I just want to run through the key components of the bill and also the key components of the amendments, and then these wonderful leaders here have a lot more to say. So overall, SB 123 would create this Foster Youth Bill of Rights that highlights the important rights that youth have when they are in the foster care system. It requires that each youth get a copy of those rights when they come into care, and that it gets updated every year that they know they still have it. It requires that youth receive all relevant contact information for those involved in their case, and that includes the lawyers, caseworkers, supervisors. And then it establishes a hotline that youth can call if they feel like their rights are being violated, and a formal grievance procedure. That's the basics of the bill as it stands. The Dash 1 amendments propose that we update it so that the youth get a copy of their rights within 60 days of entering the system. And this amendment was put in place to account for the number of youth who come in for very short amounts of time and then go back to their biological families. So we thought that that was a compromise we could make. We also, in Section 2, Part 4, we made it to be that youth age 14 or older receive their packets about services for older youth, and this is in conjunction with independent living programs' current age and structures. And then lastly, there was some clarification around developmental appropriateness of some of the pieces of this bill. So it has been discussed, as you might hear later, that the hotline and the formal grievance procedure would be housed at the Governor's Advocacy Office, and that this might require an FTE committed to solely working on foster care issues within that office. Children First believes that SB 123, with these amendments, will ensure that children and youth in foster care will know their rights and understand the process to express legitimate concerns regarding their care. And now we'll hear from these wonderful folks.
All right.
Chair Mona Anderson and members of the committee, hello. My name is Royce Markley, and I'd like to tell you guys a little bit about my experience as a youth in foster care. I'm a 19-year-old student and currently still live in foster care. 8 years in the foster care system has given me a valuable experience, an experience that I can use to help others in similar situations. I am an active advocate for foster youth throughout Oregon and am currently representing Benton County. I am here on behalf of Oregon Foster Youth Connection Legislative Committee, OFYC, and on behalf of foster youth throughout the state of Oregon. I am one of the few fortunate foster youth who was given a brief outline of my basic rights and care. Since entering the system, I have almost always had multiple people on my team that were genuinely interested in my well-being and success. My team consisted of a caseworker, a court-appointed special advocate, otherwise known as CASA, my lawyer, and multiple foster families who also had my best interest at heart. This being said, I still had many challenging experiences while in care that required me to have a better understanding of my rights than I had. There were many rights I was not aware of, such as knowing I have access to a lawyer if I need one, I am able to keep and spend my own money, I can schedule visits and be transported to see my siblings in different homes, and maybe most importantly to my case, knowing that I have the right to make a private complaint. At the age of 16, my brother and I were placed in a new foster home in my hometown of Philomath. Philomath is a small town of about 5,000 people west of Corvallis. We had an unusually family-like support system, Philomath, and we were both very happy to be home. Unfortunately, the home we were placed in was abusive and was not a healthy environment for my brother and I. The situation was difficult because I knew from experience that any complaints that were made eventually would get back to my foster parents and people would hear about it in the town we were living in. They were influential members of the community, my foster parents. They were influential members of the community, and they were perceived as small town heroes for taking my brother and I into their home. The word spread that we were complaining about our situation, and we received a lot of negative attention from both our foster parents and community members alike. If SB 123 passes into law, foster youth in the state of Oregon will have a private hotline in which youth can make formal and private complaints. This would not be a whole office dedicated to the hotline for private complaints, but simply one phone, one answering machine, and one helpful tool for foster youth. This is one implication of SB 123 that would be highly beneficial for foster youth and something that could have really benefited me in my own experience. As wards of the state, we as foster youth depend on the state to provide us with the best care possible. Supporting SB 123 gives foster youth an opportunity to make an often extremely difficult situation a little bit better. Passing SB 123 empowers youth like myself and gives foster youth a sense of control over their own destiny. With your support, we can give youth the power to navigate foster care far more effectively. If they choose to, and with your support, we can make this difficult situation more manageable. This bill will have a positive effect on 13,000 youth who spend time in foster care throughout Oregon. Youth going through this system without the shield of being told their rights are being robbed of precious knowledge. We need to know our rights in order to achieve a level of success that many youth aspire to have and that I'm sure as our guardians you want us to achieve. Please give us the power of knowledge and support SB 123. I would like to thank you guys and open up to any questions you might have.
Why don't we hear the panel and then we'll open up for questions.
Dear Chair Mons Anderson and members of the committee, hello. My name is Kane Stellings. I am 16 years old. I live in Embler, Oregon, which is about 5 hours east of here. I am a junior at Embler High School. I have been in the foster care system for 3 years, and I am here today with Oregon Foster Youth Connection to show my support of SB 123. I believe that SB 123 will not only make a huge impact on the 13,000 in foster care right now, but for those that will be introduced to the system in the future. I believe that Oregon can make a change for the better, not only for our state, but other states that want to follow our steps. There are many reasons why SB 123 is necessary for foster children. Foster children have specific rights that many don't understand. One of these rights is that foster youth and foster children have the right to talk to their caseworker in a private area so that they can file a complaint about living condition, respect levels, and privacy. Another right that many youth in foster care do not know that they have a say in is them being medicated. I personally was over-medicated in my past environment, and when I was moved into foster care, I was still being over-medicated. My foster parents knew that this wasn't right, and they made a change for the better. They later found out that I was not medicated because of my ADHD or ADD, but instead, the reason that I was over-medicated is so that my mom and my past environment can control me. Youth in foster care have a right to open a bank account. They also have a right to get a job to save for their future, and they also have the right to get their license. SB 123 is also important, because foster youth should not have to fear retaliation if they report a complaint. I feel that this bill will help foster youth feel safe and protected by the state of Oregon. It is important that foster youth understand that if they file a complaint, they will not be harmed verbally, physically, and emotionally, or be shamed for bringing up a complaint. But there's also one barrier that foster youth often face, and that is their foster parents telling them that they cannot do certain things. And to tell you the truth, it gets really annoying. Now, youth often ask themselves, why can't I? Is it because they do not know that it's their right? Do they not know that it's legally enforced? Well, guess what? They can do these things. This bill will inform youth of the rights that they have. It will show them that they do not need to feel suppressed. And most importantly, it will show them that these rights are legally enforced. Now, at this point in time, you might be wondering, why do youth in foster care need a special set of rights? Well, I'll answer that in a second, but let me ask a rhetorical question first. How difficult or confusing is the foster care system for a foster youth? Now, when a youth comes into foster care, they're introduced to 5 different people in their lives right off the bat. These 5 different people are caseworkers, counselors, lawyers, a citizen review board, and a judge. And even at the time, they might be introduced to a 6th, and that would be their CASA if they're appointed one. Now, after being placed in care, within the very first day of their new life, they are rushed to court and then placed in a home that they've never been in before. They have to try to navigate. We have to try to navigate this complicated system, and we often become lost and confused. So let me answer a question. Why do youth in foster care need a special set of rights? Because of this complication, we feel that lost, confused, and different. When we are told that we cannot see our siblings, we think it is because I am a foster child and I am different. Instead of it's my right and it's being violated. It is Oregon's job as our parents to make sure that we foster youth are treated with fairness and that foster youth are informed of their rights. SB 123 will not only make the foster youth's lives easier, but also the foster parents, because it will help them understand the roles that they play in the system and in the youth's lives. Also, if foster parents knew the rights of foster youth, they could play a role in helping youth advocate for their lives. This bill will clear up what youth can and cannot do. This gives empowerment to both the foster parents and foster youth. All foster youth have a dream. Some may want to become a firefighter, social worker, or maybe even a counselor. I have a friend that has been in the foster care system for most of his life. He was told that he could not become anything, but now he is going to college to become a lawyer. He has made a great impact on my life because he showed me that I can accomplish my dream, that I can do what I want when I grow older. My dream job is to become a caseworker for youth in foster care so that I can help them advocate for their lives. I have a dream was spoken by a man that at this point in time, society was against him. I have a dream was spoken by a visionary. I have a dream was spoken by a man that no matter what society said, he was going to accomplish his dream. Now, I have a dream is being spoken by a simple youth in Oregon foster care that has a goal much like Martin Luther King Jr. And this goal is equal rights for youth in foster care so that they can feel equal in society. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Dear Chair Monis Anderson and member of the committee, my name is Patrick Lamar Kindred, and I'm a junior at the University of Oregon. I seek to get a degree in law so that I can continue to advocate and make changes in society like the one that I'm currently after. I'm here with the Oregon Foster Youth Connection and would like to explain why I support SB 123. On behalf of the foster youth in Oregon, I would like to say thank you again for hearing our story and giving us a chance to advocate our beliefs. I have aged out of foster care, and so this bill has no direct impact on my immediate future, but I still feel it is very important to implement. The reason why it's important to implement is it establishes a feeling that you care. SB 123 is important than just making rights for youth. When growing up in the system, I also felt like there was no one who cared about me. No one had my interest in my well-being. I used to have to catch the bus or walk to my appointments, which would be fine if I also didn't have to get to school at a decent time. You see, as a kid, I didn't know that my foster parents were supposed to help me shop for clothes or even get me clothes or help provide transportation to my appointments. I now understand these are some of the rights that were being violated and were not clear to me at the time. The only thing that I was ever told that I could not do. As a kid growing up in foster care, you already have to always navigate a very complicated and challenging system. And it's really hard to do this when you don't have anyone supporting you or rooting for you or in your corner. As a foster care child, I always wanted to know that someone had my back. And the state claims to have its children's back. And by all means, I want to believe them. That is why I asked to pass SB 123 and give us, the children of Oregon, the belief that our parents have our back. SB 123 holds our foster parents to a standard that says you must treat these kids like normal people by giving them the rights that they already have in law, by educating foster children about their rights and setting up a grievance procedure in which, if these rights are violated, we can make one solid push to give foster care kids the ability to feel safe and feel protected. That's the very minimum any parent wants for their kid, and this is why I ask, as a parent of the children of Oregon, to please help us pass SB 123 so the foster youth understand their rights and care. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you. And all three of you, not excluding Pamela, are very articulate and very straightforward.
Pamela wasn't bad.
Okay. But thank you so much. It's so important for you to be here and to tell your personal stories, which have a huge impact. Yes, Senator Steiner's Hayward.
Again. So, Ms. Butler and gentlemen, why is this written that it would not apply to Kane and Royce, who are still in the foster system and will have been prior to the passage, what I hope will be the passage of this bill, because I certainly support this.
Yeah, Senator Hayward, members of the committee, I believe that the intent in the bill is that the youth didn't get their rights when they come in, when they move placements, and that they're reviewed annually. So I think there was an assumption that annually, these youth will get their rights. So those who are in care don't have it yet, but within a year would have theirs. But I believe we could clear this up.
I think we may need to check with LC about that language, because I want to be positive that people like Kane and Royce are still getting these rights explained to them clearly and in a timely fashion. I don't want it to take another year for them to get, and people like them to get these rights explained to them. I think it should really happen at the earliest possible opportunity within reason, given all the strains that are put on our caseworkers already, which we'll be hearing more about later. So if you are willing to at least clarify that and possibly entertain an additional amendment, I'd be eager to do that to protect the children who are currently in the system.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen, very much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mark McKechnie and Stacy Michelson.
Are you going to move 450 today? Hmm?
Maybe.
Okay. I just want to let you know I'm going to have to leave around 10 to 4 because it's Thursday.
Chair Monis-Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Stacy Michelson, political organizer with SEIU Local 503. No real comprehensive remarks today, just here to express our support of SB 123 and say that we do appreciate the direction that the Dash 1 amendments are moving. I appreciate CFFO's willingness to work with the agency to find the right language that ensures that youth are getting, again, the developmentally appropriate information at the right time in the right place, and taking into consideration the caseloads that workers face and wanting to ensure that we're not inadvertently adding extra work to no benefit. And I think that we are moving in the right direction, and I appreciate the amendments. We have no issue with the bill as it is supportive. Thank you.
Wonderful.
Chair Monis-Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the Executive Director of Youth Rights and Justice. We are a law firm in Multnomah County. We've represented 50,000 children, youth, and parents in the juvenile court system since 1975. About 80% of our clients are children in foster care. We're here today as well to support Senate Bill 123 and the changes in the Dash 1 amendments. As you've heard, it's very troubling that children and youth grow up in our foster care system without being aware of some of the most basic rights that they have. And this bill is one way to help fill a gap. Hearing that someone didn't know that they could get new clothes when they grew out of them, or that they had any rights regarding their medical care to at least provide input into that decision, or to find effective help if a foster home was not meeting their needs or even mistreating the child within a system that was intended to protect them. These are all very troubling things, and as Senator Shields pointed out, this is one small way to try to address some of those problems. I think it's also very important that this bill includes a requirement of notice for some of the newest benefits that have been added, especially for older youth and youth leaving foster care. It would be a shame that some of the great work that previous legislatures have done to create these new benefits for youth would be unknown by the very youth they were intended to help, and this bill also helps make sure that they get notice as well. I do want to point out, though, that this certainly doesn't address all the concerns that we should have with the foster care system and the care that children receive. I attended the forum last spring or summer as well when this concept was discussed, and some of the youth referred to a guide that we've published for several years and we make available to our clients and on our website. It's actually a 40-page summary of some of the rights that foster children and youth have, and even that kind of just covers the surface, because we intended it not to be a comprehensive explanation or a self
advocacy guide, we intended it to be a complement to the attorney-client relationship. And I want to make sure that while we are sending a message to youth that we want you to be knowledgeable and empowered, on one hand, we also don't want to go so far as to say, good luck, now that you know your rights, advocate for yourselves, and we wish you the best. Really, it's imperative that children in foster care have good legal advocates to make sure that these rights are enforced and exercised in a meaningful way. And I want to make sure that that part of the message is conveyed today. In particular, cases where children are being mistreated, they shouldn't be on their own, and they shouldn't be in a position where they are their only recourse is to complain to the agency that may be complicit in the problem or have overlooked the problem. And in a few cases that we've heard discussed in the development of this bill, that actually there's retaliation or retribution for merely a youth saying, I should be treated better, that nothing more is done to remedy the situation except that they end up worse off than they were because they made a complaint. So we're here today to say this is very important because there should be a much clearer and consistent understanding by the youth in foster care, but I think we still have work to do as well to make sure that they have all the protections they need, because children in foster care are vulnerable, and we can't expect them to be the ones taking responsibility to ensure that their rights are protected. Again, this is a very important step, and we support Senate Bill 123. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Shields.
Madam Chair, Mark, I think you bring up an important point. When this discussion started, I said, you know, foster parents should have a Bill of Rights, too. And then I'd heard that there was one, and I went back and dug around in my material from when I got certified, and I found that, you know, within a binder about this big, there was a page that said Foster Parents' Bill of Rights. And so I think we need to make sure that we're promoting these in the appropriate way, making sure that they give the right impression that these aren't restrictive. And it would be great if you and others were constantly reviewing these every year to make sure that the most important ones, like, as you'd mentioned, legislation we've had that, you know, encourages students to be able to stay at the same school despite where they might move around to. Those are things that most foster youth have no idea that they is a policy that should be in place. So it would be great if we are constantly reviewing this and not just saying, okay, we made that carbon copy of the Bill of Rights and now we never have to address it again.
I'm not sure who this question should be directed to, but I could envision that there could be a few who may abuse the system. Maybe someone who is maybe having a behavioral problems and would accuse their foster parents of things that really didn't actually happen. And I was wondering if there are safeguards or regarding that.
Chair Monis Anderson, I think from my perspective, there are allegations or claims made currently of mistreatment or neglect, and I think the best course is to investigate every one, come to a conclusion about whether it's accurate or not, and take appropriate action. And, you know, my anecdotal experience is that there are far more legitimate claims, the vast majority, and relatively few false or exaggerated claims.
Thank you.
All right, Chair Mons Anderson, members of the committee, I believe we discussed this.
Just say your name for the record.
Pamela Butler. We discussed this in some of the meetings, and we were assured from the governor's advocacy office that they have very well-trained advocates there who are already taking a lot of these calls, already hearing from youth or parents, and are good at, you know, doing some screening on their own. And then I would just So we're confident in them to be able to differentiate between the truth and maybe some stretches of the truth. And then also I would echo Mark's comment that I do believe that a lot of times there's some smoke before the fire is kind of how I've put it. And so maybe these things don't seem very big, but combined, mm-hmm. something bad is going on. And so someone needs to go check on the youth anyway. So as much as that might happen a little, I feel like often some of those little things lead to something bigger and somebody needs to be paying attention. So
wonderful. All right, any other questions? All right, now the agency hasn't signed up to testify, so I assume they're in support of the bill, although they always have to be neutral. if there are concerns, that's all we have that have signed up for this. So seeing no further, yes, Senator Cruz.
I think, Madam Chair, Senator Steiner-Hayward made some very valid points. I think we need to do some checking to make sure that the language is appropriate. Okay.
I'm happy to give you a note to Elsie if you need one.
Oh, we'd rather have you go through
Sandy.
Sandy.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. With that, I will thank you very much for coming, and I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 123.
Madam Chair, one left, but one is here. I move to suspend.
Open a work session.
Oh.
I'm going to open.
Suspend the rules. Madam Chair, I move the rules to be suspended for the purpose of allowing Senator Knope to vote on Senate Bill 420.
Right. Senator Shields was
well,
wanting
I gotta
to
do it one at a time anyway.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves to have unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow Senator Knope to be recorded as voting on Senate Bill
420.
Is there any discussion? Any opposition? Okay. So ordered. Senator Knope, do you want to record? How do you vote?
No, you just ask him.
Aye.
Okay.
Senator, let the record show that Senator Knope votes aye on Senate Bill 420.
Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of allowing Senator Shields to vote on Senate Bill 420.
Senator Cruz requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow him to be recorded.
No, not him. Senator Shields.
Senator Shields to be recorded as voting on Senate Bill 420. Is there any opposition? Senator Shields, how do you vote?
Aye.
Senator Shields, let the record show that Senator Shields votes aye.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Am I in work session or do I get out of it?
Just go ahead.
Okay. There you go. All right, now I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 165. Sandy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 165 adds the definition for cost sharing and essential benefits to the insurance code. It limits cost sharing amounts that may be required under the health benefit plans. It applies to policies and certificates issued or renewed on or after January 1, 2014. This has an emergency clause effective on passage. You do have a -1 amendment that establishes a set cap per month for an individual and a set cap for families. If you want those totals, I can put it in, but you can see it in the amendment.
Okay. I would like to call up, is this first? I don't know who. Okay, Carol Chantka, Megan Helzerman, and John Motter.
We did. Yeah, that's done. That's what we just suspended the rules to allow them to vote. So.
Oh. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Proceed.
Madam Chair, good afternoon. My name is Carol Chautka, and I'm with the Oregon chapter of the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, representing more than 7,600 people in Oregon who live with MS. The National MS Society supports Senate Bill 165 and the amendment. Although many people with MS have health care coverage, 70% of those with coverage still struggle with the cost of health care, and 30% are forced to spend less on their food, heat, utilities, and other necessities. The Oregon chapter realizes this difficulty because we provide financial assistance to some of these people to continue their medication while supporting their needs such as heat, rent, utilities. On average, the financial impact of living with MS is $69,000 per year, and more than half of this amount consists of direct health care costs. One study has found that the median out-of-pocket costs for health care among people with MS was almost twice as much as the general population. In recent years, health plans have increased the amount that enrollees pay for prescription drugs. One practice has been the co-insurance structure, where consumers pay a percentage of the drug cost rather than fixed fee. Individuals with multiple sclerosis have had to face high out-of-pocket costs for prescription drugs and MS therapies that are often found on the fourth tier or specialty tiers. The cost increase at this level is substantial, and these percentages have averaged 25% to 35%. Some individuals with multiple sclerosis have shared with me that their monthly coinsurance for MS disease-modifying medications is $800 to more than $1,000 for the medication, and some have stopped taking it as a result of these high costs. High out-of-pocket costs for the first several months of the year would also be prohibitive for many individuals. This bill limits out-of-pocket costs with the 12 equal installments. Individuals desire predictable, affordable monthly amount for their health benefit plan, and no one should jeopardize their treatment of MS due to the high cost. I urge you to support this bill and the amendment. Thanks.
Thank you. Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Megan Helzerman. I'm 40 years old. I live in Southeast Portland. Last week, I visited the Providence Arthritis Center and spent 2 hours with an IV attached to my arm. The IV was delivering biologic medication to treat rheumatoid arthritis. This treatment costs $4,267 a month and is repeated every 4 weeks. In addition, there are monthly lab tests and doctor visits every 3 to 4 months. On the Actemra medication, which is the biologic medication I discussed, I have no arthritis symptoms. I'm an active person. I'm a cyclist. I'm a skier. I'm a volunteer. In fact, I'm a CASA with the last group that was just here. And I'm a public employee. I have a more than full-time job managing federal grants that support career and technical education in the high schools and community colleges in Clackamas County. Without the medication, I have severe pain and swelling all over my body. I feel like I have the flu at all times. I'm stiff and rigid from early in the evening until mid-morning. It takes me about 2 hours just to get ready to leave the house. Something as simple as putting on my socks or buttoning buttons brings me to tears. I can barely make it through a work day, and I'm convinced that if my arthritis is untreated, I would have been on disability by now. In short, with this medication, I have a life, and without it, I do not. I have a commercial health insurance policy through the Oregon Educators Benefits Board. In the last 3 years, I've been on the medication for 2 years. It has covered 3 years of my insurance plan. And in the first year, the entire treatment was covered by insurance. I paid no out-of-pocket expenses. In the second year, 80% was covered by insurance, and I paid 20%. So I paid $600 per month. Thankfully, my coverage had an out-of-pocket maximum of $1,200. So I reached my out-of-pocket maximum in less than 2 months. In the third and current year, my insurance continues to cover 80%. However, and I pay $600 per month. However, my out-of-pocket maximum doubled to $2,400 per month. I reached that in less than 4 months. Despite this increase, I consider myself fairly lucky. I have a treatment that's working. I have insurance, and I have resources available that have helped me manage my costs so far. However, the ballooning out-of-pocket expenses force many individuals and families to choose between paying their mortgage or putting food on the table and accessing these life-altering treatments. At the rate at which out-of-pocket costs are increasing, we'll place the treatment out of my reach very soon. I encourage you to support Senate Bill 165 for two main reasons. One, it requires commercial insurers to limit and apply a consistent out-of-pocket maximum, which allows access to many life-altering treatments for Oregonians. It also allows subscribers to spread the out-of-pocket
costs over a 12-month period. My employer offers a Section 125 cafeteria plan, which in effect allows me to do this, but not everybody has access to that ability. If I were to have to pay this cost in the first 2 to 4 months of my plan, I would have no choice except to put it on a Visa card and pay it off, hopefully pay it off by the time the next year comes around. I think that these changes, the Senate Bill 165, make significant improvements to many Oregonians to make healthcare costs more predictable, manageable, and somewhat more accessible. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Hi, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is John Motter, and I'm just one of about 6,000 Oregonians living with HIV. Really, for me, advancements in medication healthcare have allowed myself and many of my friends to no longer talk about dying of AIDS, but actually talk about living with HIV. And that's a big change from my early years in Washington, D.C. in the early 80s, where that's what I saw among, you know, most of my friends. The Senate bill and the amendment really will go a long way into making sure that this trend can continue. Although my labs and doctor visits are numerous, it's really my prescription costs, my out-of-pocket costs for both my HIV as well as some of the other comorbidities that pose the largest cost. In 2012, my out-of-pocket costs for the entire year were just over $6,800, and roughly $4,300 of that came in the first 2 months of the year. In comparison to this year, I'm off of one treatment, so it's gotten a little bit better. But in those first 2 months, I've still spent $2,800 out-of-pocket. And so coupled with the insurance costs, any other co-pays, it really becomes a substantial burden to me and in reality more than what a lot of people have to pay for housing or rent. The bill, it's essential to patients and families across the state who are dealing with any sort of chronic disease. And again, many people with HIV have numerous comorbidities that affect them. Capping the monthly costs means that Oregonians will have less financial worry and be in a better position to address their illness, and patients will not have to decide what necessary medical care or prescription drugs they need to sacrifice. You know, for example, I won't have to worry about another series of seizures that will land me in the hospital for an extended stay. Over the past 2 years, I've paid $2,200 in copays for hospital rooms. That doesn't include any sort of lab copays, doctor copays while in the hospital. I am fortunate in that I have family that I can rely on to help me through some of these financial challenges. It's unfortunate that I have to ask a brother and my 80-year-old mother to help pay some of these costs when I need them. Having this bill would allow, kind of a similar situation, would allow me to spread that over time so that I was capped at a regular cost. I volunteer at Cascade AIDS Project, and we truly see this scenario time and time again. We have people come into the offices at CAP that did have jobs, did have insurance, and because of having to fall out of medical care, they've ended up homeless. They've ended up with seriously deteriorated health, and so we have to work as an agency to try and get them healthy and get them back into a successful life. Cascade AIDS Project is grateful that the Health Care and Human Services Committee is considering this important piece of legislation that benefits patients and families by capping the out-of-pocket costs for many people. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the panel? Thank you very much. Quinn Davenport, I think that's just one name. Michelle Fernandez. And it looks like there might have been a third name.
Marita
Postma?
Yes.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Senators, I'm Quinn Davenport. I took today off of work to come and testify in front of you. I'm the father of a hemophiliac. He has a prescription drug that makes him a nearly normal member of society, but his medication costs $50,000 to $60,000 a month. I've done what I believe society wants me to do, which is to get college education, go to work for a corporation that has good benefits and a health benefit that takes care of these things for us. My premiums for my share of our health benefit has risen faster than my income has. My insurance deductible for the prescription benefit doubled this year, and our prescription provider is going to change next month, and nobody that I can reach can explain what changes this entails for me. I encourage the passage of the Senate Bill 165 because even a reasonable sounding 10% copay on my prescription drugs is more than my annual income. And the amendment to keep the monthly expense fixed will help me to keep my bills manageable, because having the entire $11,950 in January is not a bill I can pay.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Chairperson Mons Anderson and Chair, or Committee, my name is Marita Postma. I'm the Executive Director of the Hemophilia Foundation of Oregon. The Hemophilia Foundation of Oregon serves approximately 400 individuals in the state of Oregon, and we strongly urge you to consider and support Senate Bill 165. Hemophilia is a genetic bleeding disorder that prevents blood from clotting properly. The main symptom is uncontrolled, often spontaneous bleeding, internal bleeding into the joints that can result in pain, swelling, and if left untreated, cause permanent damage. In about one-third of the cases, there's no family history known of hemophilia. For these individuals, the disorder results from a spontaneous genetic mutation. Hemophilia occurs predominantly in males. Women are carriers of the defective genes and may experience mild symptoms themselves. Currently, there is no cure for hemophilia. However, individuals do require lifelong infusions of replacement clotting factor therapies manufactured from human plasma or using recombinant technology. Costs for these clotting factor therapies are typically on average about $300,000 per year and can go in excess of $1 million a year if the person develops an inhibitor and an inability to take the clotting factor in. With these therapies, our patients live long, prosperous, active lives and are contributing members of society. In addition, von Willebrand's disease, another genetic bleeding disorder that prevents the blood from clotting properly, is due to a deficient or defective blood protein known as von Willebrand factor. It occurs equally in men and women, and the symptoms include frequent nosebleeds, a tendency to bruise easily, and excessive bleeding following surgery. In women, the disease can cause heavy and prolonged bleeding during menstruation and excessive bleeding following childbirth. Von Willebrand's is often undiagnosed or incorrectly attributed to gynecologic conditions. Traditionally, health insurance plans have charged fixed copays, as we've been talking about, for different tiers of medication. Each tier is set sometimes $10, $20, or $50 for the highest tier. Unfortunately, as Quinn has testified, these specialty tiers were getting transferred into specialty tiers and are utilizing high patient cost-sharing methods of coinsurance. In other policies, the insurance companies are moving these factors from major medical coverage into pharmacy tiers or prescription tiers at a tier 4 or 5. At a 25 or 33% copay for a $300,000 bill is more than most people make in their annual salary. This practice is cautioning patients at this point to underutilize treatment or go without treatment. Patients and families can't withstand these exorbitant costs, and these life-saving treatments are important for them to be able to live productive lives. Senate Bill 165, with its monthly out-of-pocket of $495.34, $495 $1,034 per individual or $995 per 84 cents per family helps these families and patients live with a chronic disease. We understand that this is still a lot of money for people, but it's predictable money, and people can work with foundations such as ours with which to help with those copays and assistance. It's so necessary for those affected with bleeding disorders who experience significant costs for these life-saving medications throughout their lifetime. A high cost-sharing mechanism puts this population at significant risk and punishes patients and families that most need limits on out-of-pocket costs. Because the goal is to increase access to these treatments, including drugs that are prescribed to a limited number of people, we feel the risk is set out upon the entire insurance pool, and the burden of these excessive copays is removed from insured Oregonians. Thank you for your support of Senate Bill 165.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Michelle Fernandez, and I am the mother of three boys, two.
It's okay.
Take your time.
You can do okay.
Two which have hemophilia, and I'm married to a husband who has MS. So I've got it all covered here today. Mm-hmm. And as I look at what we're doing, I have one son who needs infusions three times a week. And I have one who is with injuries and is raising very healthy boys. It's very unpredictable to know what they're having. We can spend a whole summer with accidents and in hospitals. So besides the cost on the medications, we're dealing with high-end things like CAT scans, infusion therapies, home nurses. The cost can be very high. And with the MS, we're dealing with MRIs periodically. And this is to keep my family healthy. I am the primary worker in my household, so I'm the one that's trying to keep this going. So when we're looking at something that we could put a cap on, it's definitely something that can make things much easier. My kids are very healthy and they're honor roll students, and, you know, so trying to keep their joints healthy, keep spontaneous bleeds from just doing nothing, you know, target joints that would cause a bleed from just walking and rolling your ankle the wrong way are things that we try to manage, things that I try to manage as a mom. And so the hardship of dealing with the health of raising healthy boys is one thing, but to have to look at the financial thing, to put numbers down, I don't make what I could do to keep them healthy, more or less keep food on the table and a roof over our head. So in support of this bill, that we would have a cap that is more predictable, is something that I definitely am supportive.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Questions? Thank you so much for sharing your story. My heart goes out to you. And the costs of health care are just astronomical. And the fact that you have children that are doing well, it's because of the medication that they're getting.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nancy Haskin, Molly, that represents Molly's fund, and Michaela's on the phone. Michaela, are you on the phone?
Yes, I am.
Great. Would you introduce yourself and please give your testimony?
My name is Michaela Harrison, and before I was diagnosed with arthritis, I played basketball and was the most defensive player. I put every muscle to work when I danced. I was athletic and always doing something. But as the pain came, stayed, and continually got worse, I knew something was wrong. Waking up and crying from the throbbing and random swelled up joints causing excruciating pain, I figured that I had just fractured something in my shoulder, arm, or hand. I went to the doctor and was diagnosed with juvenile rheumatoid arthritis on March 28, 2009. I was only 14 at the time, and I was unaware that people younger than 60 could even get arthritis. The next few months of my life were the hardest. The simplest things hurt, like opening a door, using a can opener, and shaking people's hands. I was a prisoner of arthritis, and I didn't even put up a fight to stop that. Summer came, and I graduated middle school. At the time, I was put on 10 milligrams of prednisone, which relieved me an incredible amount. I felt better and started to take advantage of that. I realized that I had just accepted that I had arthritis and gave up on what I love to do. I was robbed blind, but the rob that smiles steals something from the thief. Shakespeare. I learned to steal back my life and learned to smile the little things I never noticed before. In pain or not, I did what I wanted to because if I loved it enough, I forgot the pain. I'm 18 now, and although the prednisone has helped in the past, I have begun to regress rather than progress. My doctor urges me to go on a biologic drug if I wish to get better, though our insurance has an entirely different deductible for biologics. We would have to meet a $3,500 deductible first, and after that, they would be only willing to pay $1,200, leaving our remaining balance to be paid by the patient of $1,200 a month. How can a middle-class family of five afford this? This amendment to the bill will help spread out the yearly cap for medications over 12 months rather than pay it all in the first 2 or 3 months. I will continue to regress due to these high costs. The Senate Bill 165 will help us help reduce these high costs and help me steal back my life. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Michaela, for sharing your story.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Nancy Haskin. I live in Westland, Oregon, and I've been a lupus patient for 13 years and rheumatoid arthritis for 20 years. And I'm actively involved with Molly's Fund Fighting Lupus. I am here as well to support Senate Bill 165 to establish a stop-loss requirement, which will limit out-of-pocket costs by adding the definitions for cost-sharing and essential health benefits to the Oregon's insurance code. This bill is very important for all lupus sufferers and anyone with a chronic illness. It helps all of us who have insurance through small groups, commercial or individual plans, and have large out-of-pocket maximums. This important bill will align Oregon's health insurance and benefit plans with monthly caps, aligning with the annual cost caps provided in the Federal Affordable Care Act. Patients that hit their out-of-pocket cap in month 3 or 4, which is not unusual, won't have to pay that cap at that time. They'll be allowed to spread it out over 12 months. For an average lupus patient, we have out-of-pocket prescription costs ranging from $4,000 to $6,000 a year. Monthly, it can be hundreds of dollars, and most of us can't afford that. We have to choose which medications we have, which will impact our health each month based on our expenses. As a mom of four, a full-time employee of the Home Builders Association of Portland, and an active individual, choosing to delete a medication really inhibits my ability to be able to play any of those roles. With the passage of Senate Bill 165, more lupus patients will be able to afford all of our needed medications. The average lupus patient has several overlapping conditions, which might include rheumatoid arthritis, nephritis, which is kidney failure, Raynaud's syndrome, which your hands are always cold and tingly, Crohn's disease, which is intestinal issues, and pulmonary hypertension. To treat lupus and overlapping conditions requires multiple drugs. Some of these drugs can be covered with our copays, and some of them cannot. Thus, we have to choose which ones we can afford. We encourage you to pass Senate Bill 165 to allow us the ability to manage our health care from the best advantage. Capping our out-of-pocket prescription allows us to predict our expenses, manage our resources to cover the costs, and ultimately to give us a better quality of life. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very, very much. Is Matthew, is it?
Tache.
Tache, are you four?
Four, yes.
Okay.
Sorry about that. I was supposed to be yeah.
Hello, my name is Matthew Tache. I am 34 years old and I live in Portland, Oregon. I'm a severe hemophilia A patient. I have lived with the disease of hemophilia for 34 years, and I come from a family history of hemophilia. My brother and my uncle both passed away from HIV during the 80s crisis in the contaminated blood. During that period of time, factor drugs were made more, they purified the process, but also made the drug one of the most expensive medical conditions you can have. It's the second most expensive medical condition you can have. I've actually even brought a bill just for this month of how much my bill is. For a month, this is the month, the first of the year, my bill is $77,000 and I have to pay a deductible of $3,000 of that. So during the course of the year, which I have a medical savings account, which pays the deductible for the first of the year, if anything changes about my medical, like if I lose my insurance, anything like that, and go to COBRA and get a new job, that means automatically that bill starts right again. So I've had it twice where I've had to pay a month, had to pay $6,000 in a month. So $6,000 has happened twice. And what we're trying to eliminate here is this will never happen, you know, no patient, and if I had a family of children with hemophilia, that means I can be up to to $20,000 out-of-pocket expenses for that family. Again, we're also worried about the higher tier cost. If we post into the fourth or fifth tier, then people end up paying 30 to 50% of the cost of the medication. It would be impossible to even have insurance because you would not be able to pay up to $20,000, $30,000 a month for their medication. So I'm definitely in support of Bill 165. The amendment would bring the proposed idea is to bring it to a $5,000 or $5,950 for individual to pay for their insurance. So I'm bringing it down to a monthly cost of about $495.34. And if the person is a family, that would bring it up to $11,950, which again, foundations and different programs can help with eliminating the cost of that if you're paying per month. So a family would pay $995.84. So,
thank you.
Yeah.
Well, committee, thank you very much for coming. As you know, we are in the midst of health care reform, and unfortunately, Senate Bill 165 conflicts with the essential health benefits, conflicts with the definitions in House Bill 2240, and for the proponents of the bill, it isn't going to solve your issues right now. But we are trying this. The Oregon Insurance Code needs to align with the Affordable Care Act, and as you know, the Affordable Care Act is coming down from the feds. So that's one issue that there would be need to be quite a bit of work done to make sure that we are not in conflict with the Affordable Care Act. Also, regarding the essential health benefits and the total cost sharing, they are also not consistent with the Affordable Care Act. And again, the third piece, it imposes limits on large group and grandfathered health benefits plans that are not otherwise imposed by the Affordable Care Act. And I know that the department, the insurance division is here. They have submitted testimony to you. And I would like to hear from the opponents of the bill right now, which are health insurers. But I did want everyone to know that we are in the midst of health care reform. And unfortunately, with the Cover Oregon, which is our health insurance exchange, there's huge amount of changes that insurers have to make, et cetera, regarding the essential benefits plan. And so we have bronze and silver plan. I don't want to get into too much detail, but there is an essential benefits plan that we have developed, and it at this point in time, it looks like there would need to be a lot of work on this bill to make sure that it doesn't conflict with the Cover Oregon and what we are going through with the changes with the health insurance benefits plan. So let's call up the opposition to the bill first, and that would be John Powell and Lisa Tressel. Don't you have this?
No, I don't have that.
No.
I haven't seen it.
You haven't seen it either?
No. Did you get it from?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Lisa Tressel with HealthNet Health Plan of Oregon here in opposition to Senate Bill 165, and a lot of the main reasons that we're opposed to it, you mentioned about the work that's going on. Come January 1st, 2014, the entire world as we know it in commercial insurance changes, not only for the companies, but for the members we serve. And listening to some of the testimony earlier today, one of the things that comes to mind is that there will be subsidies and cost-sharing provisions that the ACA affords, and I'm not an expert on which of those coverages apply, but I do recall reading not only would there be subsidies for premiums, but there would also be waivers on cost shares for some people. So that could be a situation that would help. The other thing that I wanted to comment on when I understood the bill was mainly directed at pharmaceuticals is that One of our fastest growing trends is in specialty drugs as far as the cost driver goes. If you looked at unit prices of non-specialty drugs, they're flat or maybe even declining somewhat. But specialty drugs are growing at a rate of about 17%, and their unit cost is growing at a rate of 11.5%, and that's taken from a 2011 drug trend report. So it's just something that everyone is very aware of. We've got wonderful drugs available, but they're very expensive. But again, I'd reiterate that come 2014, a lot of this will change, not just for the carriers, but for every person in America that's going to be impacted. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. We're here to express concerns about this bill and how it would interact with the ACA. This bracelet that I wear is a zebra for carcinoid cancer, and one of my children has this disease. It's incurable, and he's in a pilot program right now. The drug is $8,300 a month, so I know what these people are talking about. The ACA, however, does have a limit on cost sharing, and we've already filed the plans for 2014, and the rates will be filed next month. So those are in the bag beginning January 1 of 2014. If we had to stop and implement this bill right now, I don't think the exchange could start up in October of this year. So we just want to express that concern with the committee, and also would urge you to do nothing this session that would prevent competition in pharmaceuticals. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to have Anthony Behrens come up and just address some of the things that I already put on the record.
Certainly. Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Anthony Behrens. I'm a senior policy analyst with the Insurance Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The department does not have a position on this bill at this time. I would just like to point out some items for your consideration as you contemplate this bill going forward. Currently, the state has a bill that's in the House. It's House Bill 2240, which would implement the Affordable Care Act's cost-sharing requirements. And to sort of, address some of the concerns that were raised earlier, the maximum out-of-pockets required by the Affordable Care Act are tied to an IRS regulation that moves every year. It adjusts to changes in costs. And currently, that IRS regulation pegs these particular costs at $6,250 for an individual and $12,500, I'm hoping I have this right, for families. We anticipate that in 2014, this will go up to $6,400 for individuals and $12,800 for families.
Meaning that the individuals would have to pay $6,400? Explain exactly what that means.
Certainly, Chairman Sanderson. The $6,400 would be the out-of-pocket maximum. So once a member reaches that cost, the amount they pay in deductibles and coinsurance and copays, then the carrier would then pay after that.
Thank you.
After that amount. Cost sharing is variable, so it's going to change as we progress in time, and that's one issue you might consider. Putting fixed costs in statute could create some conflict there. Additionally, the way the bill's worded, it would apply total cost sharing that's currently less than cost sharing for just essential health benefits. So, for example, as I just said, we expect those to be $6,400 and $12,800 respectively. And that's that just applies to the essential health benefits part of the plan. Plans are free to offer additional benefits. The way that we have read this bill, it would impose a lower amount on all benefits than is allowed for essential health benefits. So that may be an issue for you to consider. And then finally, the Affordable Care Act does not impose cost sharing on grandfather plans, cost sharing limitations like this on grandfather plans. There are built-in annual cost sharing limitations because if the plan changes too much from year to year, it loses its grandfather status. So essentially, there is that kind of built-in limitation. But currently right now, these limitations don't apply necessarily to large group, and so this would be a pretty significant change for the large group market.
Thank you very much. I still feel there is a concern that what happens, plans should be able to work with people who cannot pay the entire amount up front. I mean, again, I guess I need an assurer up here to talk to me regarding are there ways for them to set up payment plans without legislatively doing that? Lisa, do you want to?
I don't know. I can get back to you.
Yeah. It would be nice if the insurers could get back to me on that. All right. All right. Any questions?
Yes, ma'am.
Very complicated issue. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you.
All right. Proponents of the bill, we'll need to talk. With that, I will close the public hearing on 165 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 450. And Senator Steiner Hayward and
Tammy Bainey.
Tammy Bainey, come forward. And Sandy, do you want to?
Tammy, are you on the phone?
Yes, I am, Senator.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Is Sandy. Senator Steiner Hayward is getting to the table. But just wanted to make sure we're there. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 450 is establishing a task force on the delivery of human services. The bill specifies membership duties, powers, and functions. The original bill has a 2014 sunsets on the 2014 convening date. This has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and we do have some amendments.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Steiner Hayward. I have the privilege of representing Senate District 17, Northwest Portland, unincorporated Washington County, and parts of Beaverton. Last June, Senate President Courtney asked me and several other members of the legislature to attend a conference called Opportunities for Working Families. And this is part of a series of conferences put on by the National Conference of State Legislatures, and in this case, the Annie Casey Foundation, where they invite small numbers of states to send teams to talk about specific types of issues. And during the conference, you hear presentations, and then each state team, which in our case was myself, Senator Winters, and Representative Frederick, gets together with NCSL staff and Casey staff to talk about issues that they think could really help working families in their state. This bill is the result of that conference, because one of the issues that I identified was my concern about the amount of work it takes for a family to obtain social services when they are struggling, and especially we have seen this in these times of economic difficulties we've been facing. I'm a family physician, and we've been going through remarkable health care changes in this state and nation, as we heard some of in the with regard to the previous bill, and we're doing remarkable work in Oregon. We're a national leader in our healthcare transformation. It's time for us to start that process in our human services arena as well. I want to be clear up front. I am not here to criticize the remarkably hardworking people in our Department of Human Services, our Department of Housing, our Departments of Employment, Departments of Correction. I'm here to say that they're being asked to do an enormous amount of work and in a potentially antiquated way. And as you'll hear from other people who testify, this bill is coming forward with the support of all of these agencies. So I want to be clear. This is not a let's get grumpy with people bill. This is a how do we make the next step. So when we talk about human services, we mean all those programs and services that help struggling Oregonians return to self-sufficiency. From the DHS side, that could mean TANF, SNAP, or WIC. From housing, it could be housing assistance. It also means employment-related daycare, transition services for people leaving our correction services system, and programs that help Oregonians regain stable employment, either through job retraining or continuing education. These programs are administered by different state agencies, local governments, and nonprofits. When we look at this system as a whole, we realize it really isn't a system, that it's very fragmented and very complicated. At the risk of oversimplifying, to understand the current system, if you imagine each program represented as a separate door, an individual or a family looking for support from TANF has to walk through the TANF door. If they want WIC, they walk through the WIC door, and so on. And each time they walk through a door, they have to fill out an application, have that application processed, and then be enrolled. This requires enormous duplication of paperwork. It's degrading to our people who need services because they have to prove over and over again that they're poor enough to need these services. And it frustrates the heck out of our caseworkers. We'll hear from some of them today about how they're spending so much time doing paperwork they can't actually do casework to help people get back to self-sufficiency, which is what we all want for Oregonians. DHS recently did a survey of people served by DHS and OHA-administered programs, such as SNAP, TANF, child welfare, medical assistance, programs to serve people with disabilities. The survey found that for youth being served by either agency, only 24% were enrolled in only one program. More than 76% were involved in two or more programs, and 41% in three or more. And they all needed to repeat these applications, go through the processing, et cetera, et cetera. Often they need to renew. So I don't have specific proposals. It would be foolhardy and inappropriate for me to come in suggesting that I know how to do this better than the experts who've been doing it for all these years. And the role of this, the goal of this bill is to get together all these smart people at one table to hear what each agency is doing to streamline their services, to hear what's working well, what needs to be changed, to get a range of good ideas on the table, and to start a process that got us to where we are today, for example, with our coordinated care organizations. That took multiple pieces of legislation and several years to bring to fruition, and really, to some extent, was the result of the work starting in the 80s with the Oregon Health Plan. I hope it doesn't take us 25 years to get through this process, but I'm not expecting miracles here. What I am hoping for is a group of people to get together and talk about this. And I've been talking with a lot of these people since last June, really. And I discovered that there's a real appetite for this kind of reform. You'll be hearing from Commissioner Tammy Boehning from Deschutes County to talk about local government's role in human services delivery and some of the things that have been happening there. You'll be hearing from caseworkers from DHS. You'll be hearing from representatives of various agencies and from things like the TANF Alliance. And they'll be talking with you about their perspectives on this bill, their enthusiasm for it, and why they think it's so necessary. I hear a lot of people saying, okay, we've done a pretty good job on healthcare. We're at a place now where we need to see how this plays out. Now we need to move on to the human services arena. Because really, when I came to this legislature a little over a year ago, I came with a focus on the social determinants of health, the things that underlie a healthy Oregon, not just how we deliver actual health care, but preventing hunger, providing stable housing, providing excellence as our educational system, supporting a sustainable economy. And we can't do that if the people who need us the most are spending all their time interacting with the system and none of the time getting themselves back on their feet. We do have amendments that broaden the range of people involved with this task force that are based on just extensive conversations over the past several months, and I really support all of these amendments. I think we've got pretty broad-based support. We'll have unions at the table. We'll have representatives of local nonprofits. And I think ultimately this will get people on and off of social services faster. It will get them to self-sufficiency faster. It will make reduce our burnout for caseworkers. It will promote all sorts of things that we're trying to do. And without further ado, I'd like to ask Commissioner Bainey to add her perspective.
Okay, and we do have 11 people signed up, so if everyone could keep their comments for 2 to 3 minutes so that everyone will be able to testify.
If I could, before that, Senator Steiner Hayward, I would suggest that we need to be mindful of the potential connection between this task force and the one anticipated in Senate Bill 21.
Very good point, Senator Cruz. And just as a reminder to this committee, we heard Senate testimony in Senate Bill 21, and I think it'll be coming back next week for work session, which is regard to revamping services for aging and disabilities, and absolutely we'll be looking at dovetailing the two. Thank you, Senator
Okay,
Cruz.
And I am starting timers, so when you hear a sonar sound, you'll know that 3 minutes are up. All right, thank you. Commissioner, please proceed. Introduce yourself and proceed.
Yes, thank you. Hi, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, and my Senator Tim Canope. My name is Tammy Bainey. I'm a Deschutes County Commissioner. I'm also the immediate past president of the Association of Oregon Counties. Thank you for this opportunity to convey my support for Senate Bill 450, and in particular my support for a task force that can look at ways to integrate and streamline the delivery of human services in Oregon. I believe that at the very core of local government, we are to provide three critical things, not to say that that's an end-all, but certainly the basics. The first is infrastructure, roads, sewer, water, those types of things. The second is public safety. And the third critical role in which we share as elected officials is caring for our most vulnerable populations. And the Senator Steiner Hayward did a great job of underscoring all of those components, but I just wanted to mention counties operate as agents of the state to provide services in communities, and we represent the same people. Through public health, we do immunizations, we do the women, infant, children, the WIC program, maternal child health, home visiting, mental health services, drug and alcohol services, all to really take care of the whole person and help with that self-sufficiency piece. We often share clients with a number of state agencies, as many clients also benefit from a number of the programs that the Senator mentioned, but SNAP, TANF, Child Welfare Services, Energy Assistance, et cetera, just to name a few. What is missing is the interconnectivity of these programs and assisting those in need with getting the right services at the time when they are needed. The state and county both share in a common goal of self-sufficiency for those that we are serving, and coordinating this is critical. I had the pleasure of serving on the governor's program funding team, the Healthy People program funding team. There were five of us. And we devised a list of principles that we used in determining our recommended funding package, acknowledging scarce resources. Some of those that are critical to this are the first is focus on healthcare transformation, allowing for more flexible expenditure of dollars in order to save dollars in the future, coordination and integration for better consumer care, prioritize services to the most vulnerable populations, serve clients in the most efficient, lowest cost setting with the most integration in their own community, and maximize return on investment. Our current system does not meet these principles, and the time is now to find a better way. The state and the counties and our communities that we serve, for that matter, create the fabric of support for those in need of service. I think it's important to note that there is a place for our network of nonprofits and faith networks in the social delivery system as well, in service delivery system. We have a responsibility to deliver services in the most streamlined way possible. If we truly want to bend the cost curve on healthcare and really move toward healthier people, we need to create a delivery system that works with them, not against. We need a system that will support success, not be a full-time job just trying to navigate, which I'm sure that you will hear testimony that it currently is. With this said, I want to thank you again for the opportunity to support working together to develop an efficient and integrated network of services to assist those that we serve. And I can tell you as counties, we are ready to do what it takes in order to essentially be the no wrong door, as they say. We do a lot of the same service to the individuals that you are serving, and I just know that there's a better way if we coordinate this better. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Any questions, sir? All right. With that, I thank you so much, Commissioner. You're certainly welcome to stay on the line, and or we'll understand if you have to, you know, go offline.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
With that, I'd like to call Allison McIntosh, Suzanne Washington, and John Mullen. Please proceed.
Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. For the record, my name is Allison McIntosh, and I'm the Policy and Communications Director at Neighborhood Partnerships. I'm speaking to you today as the co-chair of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon. The Human Services Coalition of Oregon is a coalition of approximately 80 organizations across Oregon, all concerned about the future of our state and our most vulnerable neighbors and community members. We know that today too many of our neighbors and families here in Oregon are struggling to pay their rent and put food on the table and to make ends meet each month. We know that the systems and structures that help Oregonians to find the assistance they need when times are tough are stretched to the limit. We also know that as a state, we all want kids to succeed in school, everyone to have a safe place to call home, and people to be able to access the care and services they need when they need it. The Human Services Coalition of Oregon believes in an Oregon where we take care of our neighbors with low income, our seniors and people with disabilities, and families with children. Senate Bill 450 would provide us an opportunity to examine the way we deliver services to Oregonians. It would allow us the opportunity to ask whether we can make improvements to better and more effectively deliver services and what would best serve the needs of Oregonians with low incomes. HSCO knows that this is a time of change and transformation across the state, as you know, particularly as it relates to how we deliver health care services. As a result, we've recently adopted principles to guide us through this period of systems change. I've submitted a copy to you for your reference. And they articulate that discussions of change should include a person-centered approach and strive to protect low-income Oregonians. Senate Bill 450 would seek to create a task force to examine the delivery of human services in Oregon and would pull representatives from a wide range of systems to consider how we might deliver services in a way that's more effective for Oregonians. We believe the task force should consider a range of questions, including questions regarding referrals to services, no wrong door policies, and connections between services. The Human Services Coalition of Oregon knows that today our systems for delivering services to low-income Oregonians are stretched to capacity. Staff and agencies do the best they can with the limited resources they have available. Creative thought and attention have already led to some examples of innovation and streamlining services across our state. The Human Services Coalition of Oregon supports the consideration of how we can more effectively deliver services Oregonians need when they need it. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Let's go through the panel first. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Senator Moines Anderson and other senators. My name is Suzanne Washington. I am with Impact Northwest, a private nonprofit social service agency in Washington and Multnomah counties. I am here to agree that we need to look at the systems that we've created and how we can better streamline services to make sure the limited dollars we do have get to the people who need it the most. And that does include staff who are trying to work with people, and it's inadequate to support them as well. So I've been in this business for over 20 years, and I have to say that when I started, it has certainly gotten much more challenging. We used to be able to actually use four pieces of paper to get somebody rent assistance and get them into housing. We didn't have to go through 15 different models. We had one, we used four pieces of paper, and today it's five times that. It has literally gone from about this much to this much. I think we've created systems that were meant to be excellent service delivery model, and because of budget cuts, they've been impacted over and over again. So we've recreated models that have ended up being not what they were meant to be, and they're inadequate to provide the services we need today. Both, as I said, both staff are impacted as well as the people that we need to get the money to. We have lost the ability to provide the adequate support to families struggling to get out of poverty, transition out of homelessness, or even prevent eviction. If we had less paper, we could work with people better, more efficiently, and get them out and on their own faster. I know that there are multiple and complex funding systems and eligibility requirements that have created greater challenges to serving people. In my organization, we have over 15 different housing programs. Each of them comes with their own eligibility requirements. To get a family into the right program is often not... It comes with the wrong eligibility requirements. And so I'm constantly struggling to mold a family, maybe a square family, and get them into a round hole because of eligibility. They would be best served by this program, and the eligibility is $200 off, let's say, in an income limit. And so they are into another program that really is not going to meet their needs as best as they could, nor move them as quickly as they could out of the system and onto their own. So I do urge that we look at the systems we've created and that have been modified based on lack of funding and constant funding, and see if we can come up with better ways to streamline it and both support social services, nonprofits, state government, all the workers to better help the people that we need it the most. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. And also just want to underscore quickly about the Human Services Coalition of Oregon. When we formed the Human Services Coalition of Oregon back in the 80s, it specifically was lowercase. So this works for the whole discussion across the waterfront as the Senator has described it. Sometimes I describe myself as going back to the beginning of time, which isn't exactly true, but it almost feels like it at times. When I first started in human services, it was 1975. We had no technology. The technology was not unlike the 19th century about how you wrote letters and you mailed things and so forth. But we were pretty resourceful back in those days and figured out how to make systems work and work directly with people. The advent of technology was not always our friend. We wound up with a lot of very complex systems. As the chair knows, I went on to be the director of Clackamas County Social Services. We wound up merging 5 different organizations, had about 65 different funding sources, 200 contracts and letters of agreement. But we had an ethic about working together and about working together in our community, and that was really very important. So I like the idea about thinking about a task force like this. I've been through many different reorganizations, various attempts to do things differently over the years, some of which didn't work very well, frankly. We at times would create whole cloth ideas about how to streamline systems and submit them to the state, and they would say, yeah, thanks a lot. And nothing would happen. But things have changed at the state level. There's different leadership there. In fact, actually, one of the things we used to do with our managers is we would ask for solicit advice on how to change things and simplify things right at the worker level. One of my supervisors used to call these meetings, what's the stupidest thing I have to do meetings, and would generate all kinds of really interesting ideas about how things that were put in place, policy issues and technology problems, were put in the way of serving people. And so just to conclude by saying what I think has changed now, which makes this a good opportunity, is that the leadership at the state is different and open to a variety of things, everything from lean systems to different ways of looking at how services are provided, but also through the work that you all have done, like the creation of the coordinated care organizations, healthcare transformation, whatever will emerge out of this session about the Early Learning Council, and whatever will emerge out of this session about prison reform. All of these things, I think, are anticipated in the legislation that the senators put forward, including housing and community services being part of that, and we don't know the future for what's going to happen with that organization. So I think I just heard the beep, but I would just thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I know we'd all be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much.
Perfect timing.
We're right on. Any questions? Thanks so much for coming. Tanya Staines and Wayne Ground and Carrie Stepasnik. Please proceed.
Tanya unfortunately had to go. She's kind of...
Yeah, I'm sorry. Thank you both for waiting.
So. I'm going to be heading out really quick because I have to go watch two of my kids on my caseload do their last swim lesson today. So, down the street. My name is Carrie Stepnick. I'm currently a social service specialist for child welfare, permanency worker. What that means for child welfare is once an assessment's done on a family and the issues cannot be resolved within that first 30 to 60 days, it's passed on to me, and I'm the one that continues on to meet the state and federal guidelines of working with this family, giving them the services that they need. I'm here today to support the Senate Bill 450, the Dash 3 amendments about this task force. I would encourage frontline workers to be able to participate in this task force, because I'm one of those frontline workers, and I can tell you there are inefficiencies, not to mention our staffing levels, which Senator Steiner Hayward has already heard me talk about, you know, the devastating amount of low staff levels that we have. My office alone, just on the child welfare side, is at 62%, which means I do the work of 1 3/4 workers. I have 19 cases on my caseload. I have to see 25 kids every month. I have to see their moms every month. I have to see their dads every month. And there, I am pushing papers. I am absolutely pushing papers. And the example I can give you is we last year ago, August, we switched over to the ORCIDS operating system to meet our federal guidelines and requirements. And in that system alone, I spend so much time because I not only have to put together my case plan, I then have to go in and I have to put together a child-specific case plan for each child on that caseload, which is exactly what my case plan already says. And heaven forbid one of my areas on my form doesn't pull from one of the areas of this operating system, and then I have to try and go search where do I find where this field is supposed to self-populate. And honestly, at this point, my supervisor has given me permission to kind of skip. It's not a vital field. No one's going to die from it not being filled in. But skip that, because we just cannot locate in the system where it's supposed to auto-populate. And these areas are grayed out. I'm not allowed to even type in there at that point. And I can't tell you the countless hours that I have spent trying to fill in these forms that I'm required to have, that I'm required to submit to CRBs, that I'm required to submit to judges. And that's not to mention every time I fill out a referral, I'm repeatedly filling in these clients' names, dates of birth. I could probably tell you every kid's date of birth on my caseload because I've had to write it so many times. So these are absolutely the efficiency, you know, inefficiencies we need to look at, and I would encourage, strongly encourage, frontline workers to be involved.
The Dash 3 amendments, Dash 3s or 4s, 3s, do include representation from frontline workers. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Chair, you hear the same story in every field office.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And it's just the way the system has evolved itself.
It's a nightmare, honestly, for a worker and for our families that we serve. It's a nightmare.
Gary's nodding back there, so.
All right.
Chairman Anderson, members of the committee, I am, my name is Wayne Ground. I'm an eligibility worker on the self-sufficiency side, so with DHS. I'm here today also speaking in favor of the Dash 2 amendments. Meaningful change is needed within DHS, and for a lot of years we've seen an unending string of piecemeal stopgap measures, each claiming to revolutionize the work. The reality is that very few of these changes have actually resulted in improvements for clients or for workers, for that matter. New data systems don't talk to old systems. Even attempts to reduce paperwork have created more work in some cases, as we just heard. To be perfectly honest, some changes at DHS have felt kind of top-down, and workers are tired and weary of the latest and greatest thing. Taking a slower approach and a longer-term look at needed changes is the right step, including frontline workers in the process is equally needed. It's one thing for management to talk about better serving clients, but often they're removed from the daily work of all the steps involved in a particular role in a particular program. And with apologies to Jerry and the others sitting in the back row, I didn't realize you guys were going to be here when I was here talking. Please don't think I'm capping on you, okay? I'd like to take a moment, if I may, to give you one example among many that came to mind when I was asked to come here today to speak. How changes made with the best intentions by our central office impact staff in the field. I'll qualify this by saying that from a client's perspective, this is, or supposed to be, an invisible improvement. But from the agency's perspective, the additional complications are confusing and counterproductive. I realize that this is a preparatory move in the direction of going as paperless as possible. However, it was too perfect an example to not share with you. Some time ago, the agency started generating redetermination applications to a self-sufficiency program, SNAP program recipients, in a batch process about 45 days before the end of their certification period. Along with these applications, the client was sent an envelope to return it, not to their local branch office, but to a central unit in Salem that would then scan the document into our electronic document management system, and then they'd destroy the original. Every day, my team then checks the queue of scanned applications from the day before. There's no way of us updating which applications we've addressed already, so we have to keep a separate log on the local branch server. We have one, or in some days several, workers tasked with cold calling these applicants. If we don't reach them, we then print the cover page of the application and forward that to our scheduler. If we do reach them, then some workers print the application anyway to go through it over the phone with them. If a case has to be pended due to lack of information, we print the application at that point and stick that in a centralized filing cabinet until either the time runs out or the applicant returns what we've asked for, which is then worked by the worker of the day, which is usually yet another worker in the process. We then give the completed application back to the original worker that conducted the intake, where it sits in the file until somebody needs to see it, which is usually a reviewer or an investigator or somebody. So to recap this process, the agency mails out an application. When it comes back, it's scanned as an image file. Then it gets printed and stuck in a file until we're done with it, and then it gets scanned back again and archived again electronically. We've gone from application to image to application and back to image again with a lot additional documents generated along the way that follow the same process. So it's kind of a...
Boy, eye-opener.
It's a convoluted process, and it was supposed to be an improvement. And from a client's perspective, it is, but from our process, it's just like, why are we doing this? So,
thank you so very much.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I really thank both of you for taking the time.
Yes,
I know that
absolutely.
You've got a gazillion other things to do, and I'm very grateful not only for the work that you're already doing, but for your willingness to participate in this process. So, thank you both.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. I would say one of the first things we need to do is look at the federal requirements and what the feds have done to us. And I was involved way back in the mid to early 90s with the Paperwork Reduction Act at the federal level that doubled the amount of paperwork uh-huh. required. And so a lot of this is federal, and so we're going to need to get a good handle on the front end of this is what's required from that level down to us. So
thank you both.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Lynn Jackson, Eva, is it Rapito, and Cindy Booth. And the last one, cleanup, is Gene Farr.
DOC
okay. may have left, yeah. but they're on board.
Right.
They like it.
Okay. I'll be really brief. Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, thanks for your time today. My name is Eva Ripito, and I'm representing AFSCME Council 75. Our members who work in social services are always looking for ways to improve the services they provide and are supportive of this and love that frontline worker voice has been added to the task force. So we're supportive, and thanks for your time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am the I'm Lynn Saxton. I'm the Executive Director of Youth Villages Oregon. Eva neglected to mention that we both serve on the Early Learning Council together because Oregon is a small state. I'm pleased to be here today. My organization is in very, very committed to integrated services producing measurable results for families, including resulting in independence and self-reliance. We currently provide integrated services to seriously troubled youth and their families, and among other things, we help them navigate formal services delivered by public and private agencies, as well as natural supports like neighbors, churches, friends, community organizations. Our approach to each family is unique, and our organizational commitment is to literally whatever it takes to support the family to success and independence. This can include skills training, therapy, psychiatric help, medical help, whatever it takes. Last weekend, my job on Saturday was to find charitable funds for a storage unit for a mother who had been homeless for a number of months while her son was receiving psychiatric care. So we do believe that service integration is possible. We know the process engineering mechanics that are required to make it possible, and we are committed to finding every possible solution in Oregon to efficient service provision for children and families in crisis.
Great.
Thank you very much. Thanks for making the trip back down here again today.
My pleasure.
I really
Thank
appreciate
you.
It.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much. Jean Farr?
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, thank you. It's interesting. I ordinarily testify before you as a leader for Albertina Kerr Centers, and I'm affiliated.
State your name for the record.
Oh, sorry, Jean Farr. But today I'm talking to you as a sister. One of the greatest joys in my life and one of the most serious and sacred responsibilities of my life is supporting my brother, who is 1 year younger than I am at 54, to navigate through many of the systems that you've been hearing about today. And as somebody who is a professional in the human services system, it has been an incredibly challenging task for me to try to navigate across the systems. And it's become incredibly clear that there are many fantastic people working in the systems, and people are doing great work, but the systems weren't designed to work together, you know, and they also weren't designed for some of the users. So I'm really excited at the idea of Senate Bill 450, and I'm really excited about a work group working together with a whole bunch of smart people, as you said, Senator Steiner Hayward, to figure out how we can help people receiving human services navigate and how we can streamline some of that. It is unbelievable how difficult it is. And if it weren't for me managing my brother's mail, managing my brother's, you know, reminding him, he would not have a place to live, and he certainly wouldn't be able to work when he does. He's been on the low-income housing list for 9 years, and this is the year that he has come up for review after 9 years. But were he not to have responded to certain letters by certain dates over all these years, he would have been taken off the list. And I manage his mail, because I discovered a few years ago when I went to sort of help him sort through some bills that I was getting calls about, that he hadn't looked at his mail in 2 years. It's just not something that he does. And I'm learning, because my brother is extremely talented in many ways, I'm learning ways in which he's not able to support himself. But the difficulty I have in working with my brother in the VR system, in the housing system, in human services around food assistance is staggering how difficult it is for me, somebody who's a 20-year expert in Oregon Human Services. So I'm grateful for the opportunity to support this bill, and I look forward to seeing the good work that it can do.
Excellent.
Thanks much.
Thank you so very much.
Absolutely.
I could just say,
yes,
Chair?
Please.
I really want to express my gratitude in particular. We were talking yesterday. It turns out she's one of my constituents,
yes,
which is particularly nice, and I prevailed upon her. It turns out she was coming for the Human Services sub, and when I learned that, I prevailed upon her to stay, and I'm very grateful because I do a little bit of arm twistings, and I'm very grateful for your support. Thank you.
Thank you so very much.
Madam Chair, just one correction. This task force will be a whole bunch of really smart people and then a few legislators as well.
And we're really smart in figuring out that we have to get other smart people to actually tell us that's the right thing to do.
And it is important to make sure that this task force isn't going awry from whatever is going to come out of Senate Bill 21.
Right. Yeah, I'm pretty confident, Madam Chair, that we can make sure that that doesn't happen. I think that the goals of Senate Bill 21 are very congruent with the goals of Senate Bill 450, and I'm confident that with the collaboration that we've already set up, there'll be people from aging and disabilities who will be on Senate Bill 4, the task force established by Senate Bill 450. So there'll be a good liaison, and we may end up with one or more legislators who are on both of them, since
that's quite likely. But I do think both of them are equally important.
I agree completely, yeah. And I think that they're true, and partly related and equally necessary.
Yes.
So I'm not worried about that, and I don't think DHS is worried about that at all either. Aging and disabilities. No, DHS is not worried about it. I see heads in the back of the room. Good. Lovely. Thank you.
Well, thank you so very much, and everyone who came to testify. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 450, and we are adjourned.